They called Dr. Edward Luttwak the Machiavelli of Maryland. He is a military strategist, geostrategist, negotiator, problem solver, soldier, cold warrior, weapons designer, columnist, historian, author, and much more. He advises presidents, prime ministers, governments, armies, intelligence agencies, world leaders, and superpowers. His books and articles have devoted followings among academics, journalists, business people, military officers, and decision makers at the highest levels. His book, Strategy, The Logic of War and Peace, is used as a textbook at universities and military academies across the world. He is best known for his book, Coup d'État, A Practical Guide, which was published in 1968. It is this book that introduced me to Dr. Luttwak nearly two decades ago. It was an honor and a privilege for me personally to speak with a man whose work I have studied and admired for so long. The following is a conversation with the Grand Master himself, Dr. Edward Luttwak. The first question I have for you, sir, is what is the nature and the magnitude of the threat that India faces from China along this the Tibet border? And do you expect this threat to grow over the next decade or so?
Well, it has been growing recently. There is a buildup in what the Chinese call the plateau region. They don't use the term Tibet. They call it the plateau region. In Chinese, there's a Chinese expression. And there's a buildup. Every day they bring something else. They announce that they have some special armored vehicles with oxygenation equipment because there isn't much oxygen there. So normal diesel engines don't work well. Special clothing, tents, artillery. They bought special articulated two-side tractors for the ice to be able to go over glaciers. They have a fairly advertised buildup. It's an advertised buildup. There's nothing secret about it. And that buildup has been accompanied by pressure on the line. For example, there was recently some PLA soldiers filmed on the Galwan River beyond the previous patrol line. So there is a pattern of provocation. And if the Chinese were acting, let's call it, in a normal strategic way, it would mean that they are planning to do something in Arunachal. When you present the threat on a table in front of your enemy, unless you're a complete, retarded, you must be trying to attract his attention while you're doing something else. But then again, it could just be for show. It could be just demonstrative. The fact that it's very difficult to interpret Chinese behavior because the Chinese have been strategically irrational throughout their history. That's why the history of China is the arrival of three men on horseback, whether they would be Kitais or Yurchen, or eventually Mongols, and finally Manchu. Three men on horseback, and while Chinese generals exchange clever quotations from Sun Tzu, these three guys come in, they defeat the Chinese army, they then proceed to rule China for 100 years, 200 years, 300 years, and so. Indeed, there was only one Chinese dynasty in the last millennium and a half, and that was the Ming. And the reason is that he was free of Chinese culture. He was a bandit. Ming was a bandit. So he wasn't handicapped by having this delusionary strategic idea. Because one of the things about the Chinese throughout their defeats and subjection to foreign conquerors was the delusion that they're good at strategy. And there's a further twist to the story because some Westerners have endorsed this, oblivious to Chinese history, as if Chinese history were a sort of mystery. And people like Kissinger say, oh, yes, Chinese strategy and so on. And indeed, he fabricated the story, which went all around the world. He asked Zhou Enlai, what do you think about the French Revolution? So this was in 1972. So the French Revolution was of course, 280 years on. And Zhou Enlai said, it's too early to tell. Whereupon Kissinger told the whole world that he had a two-century perspective. These Chinese, you know, they're two-century perspective. Actually, Zhou Enlai thought he was referring to the 1968 big riots in Paris that caused the resignation of Charles de Gaulle, which had occurred 4 years before. And indeed, it was too early to tell. But so what we have here, unless all the history books have been falsified by people who hate China and so on, is the strategic fact. Now, this means today, when you look at the buildup in Ladakh, facing Ladakh, and you hear them keep reiterating every week that Arunachal is actually southern Tibet and that it's actually theirs, it's hard to interpret because of the history of strategic failure. Their autistic behavior makes it hard, because if they were not autistic, you would say, well, they're presenting a threat to Ladakh. They advertise the threat to Ladakh. But of course, we do know they claim much more territory in Arunachal. And therefore, this is a cover for a planned grab of Arunachal, or as much as a repeat. Now, it would be a repeat of October 1962. And that was a big victory for Mao Zedong, because his great leap forward had failed. He was down, and the Liu Shaoqi, the chairman, was really the boss. Mao's position was insecure. Once he pulled off this victory over India, because India was definitely defeated, Mao was reestablished through this. Xi Jinping is not in trouble the way Mao was because of the failure of the culture, but he, in his ever-changing definition of his own status, from just being a mere party secretary general, president, chairman of the military commission, to some sort of semi-god, with all the other standing committee political members reduced to listening, or having their heads down and reading his holy words while he speaks over them. Because of this, anything is possible. Makes prediction hard, but a prudent defense policy cannot be based on speculation, and it must be based on a rational actor model. You know, in other words, one has to, even with the Chinese, one has to pretend they're rational. If they're rational, the threat to Ladakh is apparent, the threat to Arunachal is real. And Arunachal, of course, is extremely difficult to defend because of its roadless status. Have you ever been to Arunachal?
I have not.
You have not. Most Indians have not. But let me tell you, if you look at Arunachal flat on the table from the Brahmaputra River all the way to Tawang, which is not the border, but close to the border, you would measure approximately 200 kilometers. If you want to drive a truck, on the other hand, you're going zigzag, because there are no bridges, there are no tunnels. It's all done by the Border Road Organization with shovels. And therefore, you're going interminably right, left. So the distance is not 250 kilometers, but it's more like 1,800 kilometers, which means that if you have an Indian army unit up front there, firing a mortar, you know, a mortar in the simplest form of artillery, you drop bombs and they go off and so on, you can fire off a truckload of bombs in a few hours, a couple of hours. And then to replace that truckload, it would take several days for that truck to reach your back, except in wartime conditions, there'd be traffic jams and so on. So in other words, Arunachal is hard to defend. And yet, something must be done about it. So the normal procedure, of course, is to say, no, I'm not going to defend this long and complex border and this territory. What I'm going to do is that if you take any of my territory, I will grab some of yours at the place of my own choosing, anywhere along the border. That is the way nobody serious ever fights defensively in mountains. You cannot fight defensively mountains because each position appears to be very strong as it sits on a peak. But in fact, it can be bypassed, and if then they become stranded on their peak. That is why no sensible general has ever defended in the mountains. They defend behind or in front and so on. So in this case, you don't defend. You say, okay, you can't cross the border. We ignore you. Your claims are invalid. And if you grab any of our territory, we will grab some of yours where we choose. And things of that sort. In other words, somebody in India better think in those terms.
But is India currently capable of capturing Chinese-held territory, let's say in the Tibetan Plateau, etc.,
No. I mean, you wouldn't do it in the Tibetan Plateau because the border between China and India is complex on both sides. But if they grab, if they penetrate and access in Arunachal, you can penetrate and access in China. And because the alternative, which is to defend, it's not possible. It can't be done. Now, there are other things one can do, and that is to outpost the area, namely very few soldiers just to make sure that you know what's going on. And then use air power. Use air power. And here, India's current strategic alignment comes in useful because the Americans, who are very reluctant to put troops on the ground, and certainly there, because there'll be no logistics and usual stuff, they don't have air power. And air power is very readily available. And if India, which is a country with which the United States has signed agreements, not as an alliance, there's no treaty obligation to defend, but there is a sort of understanding, strategic understanding. And that being so, the United States could provide air support. It's conceivable. The Indian Air Force itself, of course, if the Chinese choose to do a land grab and try to keep it below a threshold, then it would be up to India to use its air power. They would not use air power to keep it below the threshold, but India would have to escalate. It is normal that the defender must escalate. The offender, you know, the one who invades and attacks, he doesn't want a war. He wants to grab territory and he wants people to accept his invasion. And the occupier is never aggressive. It's the people who resist the occupation that are aggressive. The occupier just want to come in. So, but these are all things that are real, and the Indian government's position, this I believe, is that they also believe that Xi Jinping is bellicose, that he is in his Mussolini phase, you know, that he wants to show that, somehow he wants to show the Chinese are great warriors. If you saw the film clips of Gawan, I suppose you've seen the film clips of the Gawan fighting, all of it, it's all about portraying the Chinese who are a bunch of noodle merchants to show them that they're like Germans or Russians, you know. That's what, you know, they have this compulsion, this need, you know. So the Indian government attitude is that perhaps he is bellicose. He wants to fight somewhere. Let it not be India. So the Indian side is very conciliatory. As you know, India did not join the diplomatic boycott of the Olympics. There's no ambassador in Beijing, the chargé d'affaires. He was supposed to sit there, not boycotting. And then what did the Chinese do? They pick a torchbearer, who is the notorious character who did this display for the cameras of being tough. You know? I met people like this even on the battlefield. You know, they're not the real thing. It was for the cameras. He acted like this. He ignored the Indian officer standing next to him. You must have seen the film clips. The clips, I hope you did. There's an Indian warrant officer standing next to him. And he ignores him completely. As you say, rawr, rawr, rawr. These are Chinese behaving like Germans. it's not a very convincing show, but you know.
Is India being too conciliatory, and is it going to pay any dividends?
No,
just being conciliatory?
Listen, the foreign minister of India is possibly the best prepared foreign minister on the planet. I mean, the fellow was a diplomat all his life, and then drops out of diplomacy at the top and becomes runs for election, and he's now a foreign minister. But he's not like everybody else's foreign minister, who is a politician who maneuvered and he couldn't get the ministry he really wanted, the one with money in it, you know, and then he becomes foreign minister. Now, this guy is an expert, and he's particularly an expert on China. He served there as an ambassador and studied it very thoroughly. Moreover, he was brought up as a strategist by his father, Krishna Swami Subramanian, who brought him up. I mean, so he, as I say, he's the world's best qualified foreign minister. Therefore, he's not going to be naive and he's not going to be conciliatory because he's a weakling. His game is let the bellicosity in China be vented somewhere else. Don't attract it. You know, let if somebody has to bleed, why not should be somebody else other than India? That's his game, which is what I suppose a foreign minister of a country is supposed to do. But I hope that the military people take this seriously and take into account the contingency and so on. But I'm not, you know, very enthusiastic about what they're doing. You know.
I see. So what specific steps does India need to take strategically and militarily to counter the threat along the northern border?
Well, remember that nobody should devote large resources to defend the border. An armed force that becomes a border guard is not an armed force that can defend the country effectively. And I'm talking about Army, Navy, Air Force, ground forces. You should not string out your troops along 3,000 plus kilometers of border interrupted by Nepal. And you know, you shouldn't do that. So the way to defend the border is to, well, one, sort of invigilates the border. One has outposts, you know, so that if people cross, you notice it, you know. So, and then you have to have either the counter move, which is grab whatever you want, I'll grab more, where I choose, or retaliation, which is that since the PLA ground forces are composed of children. Single children, single boys who have the descent of two families. Now, I don't know how it is in Indian culture, but in Chinese culture, ancestors, if a person dies out without a brother and so on, all the ancestors disappear. You lose all your ancestors. It's a big deal. So, nobody in history that I know of has ever fought a war with an army manned by single children. And here are Chinese people who have this whole ancestor wag and so on. Indeed, the only time the Chinese ever fought very hard was during the Korean War, when the Kuomintang, the soldiers of Kuomintang, had blackened their families in the villages, and the Reds in the villages were persecuting them because the fellow had served in the Kuomintang, the defeated the nationalists, right? So all they had to do, and therefore they were cut off from food and, you know, real problems, and they were getting pummeled and by the Reds. So the Reds were calling them black, and the blacks were getting really penalized. So all they had to do was to volunteer to go for the Korean War, and make sure that they died, and then the whole family would be restored. Immediately they would become white, as they call it, instead of black, or red, I should say, red. So there was a lot of motivation for these Chinese who fought in the Korean War. Now, but when they were fighting against the Japanese, they had no success at all. When the war stopped in the armistice because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Japanese army was in control of Beijing, Shanghai, Nanjing, Guangdong, and the whole eastern part of the country. The Chinese attempts to dislodge them were quite ineffectual. They didn't fight. They didn't fight hard at all. In the Korean War, they did, because they had a reason. In other words, they were fighting for the families. They were restoring all the families, all the brothers and sisters and uncles and so on. Today, it's gone, that family, run by the, you know, that's gone. Now they have single children. And as I say, nobody in history has ever fought a war with an army of single children. That's why when four of them died, they made such a big deal about it. First, they concealed it, as you know, and then it took a long time to release it. And then they had made all this hydrographic treatment. They're all saints, all elevated to be, you know, great figures. Gave it, it's obviously, if the Indian response to a Chinese attack is to kill a few thousand Chinese troops, that might cause the fall of the regime. Or whatever it would cause. I mean, it's a pretty big thing.
Yes.
You know, for them. So the key is that India cannot spend all its money, all its efforts to defend this border. Otherwise, it become an impotent and powerless country that couldn't defend itself, couldn't defend Rajasthan against Pakistani battalion crossing over, right? So you have to have minimum defense in the mountains, no serious general defense in the mountains, just outposts, and then retaliation by air, by ground, work out a scheme where just, and you kill lots of Chinese. There's no way around that. There's no way around
that. Now, like you mentioned, the Chinese have historically fared very badly when someone invades them. Three guys on a horseback, like you said. So is that the way to go? Is China being allowed to be very belligerent? Is there a need to put them under pressure?
Today, we're in a different world. We're in the world of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So there are nuclear thresholds. You know, the great Krishnaswamy Subramanian, I first met him when he arrived in Washington decades ago, the father of Jai Shankar. And he said, India needs nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are too powerful to be useful, or to be usable, I should say. But they're still useful. How they're useful? By establishing a nuclear threshold. And between us and Pakistan, it would force the Pakistanis and the Indians, that's how you put it, to lower their warfare from the large-scale wars of the time, I'm thinking of 65, 71, and so on, which were very costly and expensive wars, where could have easily got out of hand and also triggered off massacres of Muslims in India and remaining Hindus, and, you know, horrible stuff. And Subramanian said, we have a nuclear weapon. We have very few of them. We have a no first use. India will never be the first to use it. And this way, we will compress, we'll create this nuclear threshold, and therefore our fighting with Pakistan would get smaller, like Kargil and Yachen, symbolic stuff, basically small scale, symbolic. That was his prediction. And as you know, he scandalized everybody by saying that Pakistan should also have a nuclear weapon, also no first use, also small numbers. You don't need 1,000 missiles for that sort of thing. And therefore, then there would be a low threshold. That was his prediction. And he was at one hell of a strategist, because his prediction worked out exactly right. Since the two countries became nuclear, their fighting has been of a sort of symbolic, demonstrative kind. Kargil was a little more serious, but it too was obviously very limited. It's not like that they pulled the Kargil surprise, right? India did not respond by mobilizing its army to march on Islamabad. It didn't. It handled it and so on. And same on the other side. So that threshold applies to China. It applies to all countries in the world. In other words, you can't start invading China, conquering Beijing or something of the sort. But if they attack across the border, you can attack across the border. And it's okay to attack, but it's not okay to defend. If you defend, you lose all your strength in an attempt to hold every hill and every valley and every point, and it just cannot be done.
Right. Now, this one thing that we have seen over the past 30 years, that China, which has historically and traditionally been a land power, it is transforming itself into a major maritime naval power. So what's the nature and the magnitude of the threat that India faces from China, the naval threat in the Indian Ocean?
Well, first of all, the Chinese Navy has a long way to go before it has real capability. Secondly, the most likely place where Indian armed forces will not be alone is at sea. In any crisis, it would take huge things for, let's say, the Americans to send a battalion of troops, which would also be absurd given the magnitude of India's forces and so on. Whereas naval cooperation is very likely. Let's say that the Chinese launch a full-scale offensive or something, and India appeals for American air support, okay? The United States would then have to be concerned about escalation, whatever, but there would be air support, in my view, if there was a large-scale attempt to grab Arunachal or something of the sort. India asked for support, they would get support. Most certainly, they would get support such as tanker support, electronic warfare support, not necessarily fighters coming in and fighting. So, Navy is altogether more likely. The Indian and Chinese navies exercise together quite regularly. They have the big advertised exercises, the Malabar exercises. They have other exercises, but in between exercises, they're still commune quite a lot, they communicate, they interact, and so on. And submarines, there's any floating thing belonging to the Chinese Navy is a hull in the water, can be knocked out by a torpedo. And that torpedo could be Indian or Japanese or American. And that's why the last thing that India's military planners should worry about is the Chinese Navy. The very last thing. They can move around, show the flag. They have a base in Djibouti, as you know, some sort of base in Djibouti, and they can go back and forth. But they never became a threat to India. First of all, India has considerable capability. It could have 10 times more, but it has capability. But that is where the Allies can really help a lot. And well below, very discreetly, nobody would even know. I mean, ships get sunk, you know. Torpedoes hit ship goes. And one U.S. nuclear attack submarine, one, can take out every ship of the Chinese Navy that is worthy of a torpedo. Torpedoes are expensive. I would say that India should not worry about defending itself from the Chinese Navy at all, and should instead think in terms of controlling the Indian Ocean from an aircraft carrier called India. India is a triangle going in with the Andaman and Nicobar Islands on the east side. India can close the Straits of Malacca. It can close the Persian Gulf. And it can close the Suez Canal on condition that it stops wasting all its money on an aircraft carrier, which eats up the Navy budget, and which is a single hull that contains maybe 26 fighters, which is not available every day of the year, and is not available this, and it cannot be on the east side of India and the west side at the same time, below it at the same time, and so on. The Indian Navy needs to be weaned away from its aircraft carrier obsession, just because the Americans, they were the great weapons of the Second World War. The Americans keep them to show the flag. But the capital ship of today is not the aircraft carrier. It's the submarine. The submarine is today's real weapon. The aircraft carrier is for show. And it grieves me that the Indian Navy, which has a lot of good officers, cripples itself by wasting all this money on an aircraft carrier, whereas it should have is land-based aircraft. The Navy should have land-based aircraft, which are stationed in Nicobar and Andaman Sound to close the Straits of Malacca at will. In the south, in the east, and the west, on the western side, they can control access to the Persian Gulf and the Suez Canal with land-based aircraft, long-range land-based aircraft that can stop ships. You know, they wouldn't. So let's say that China attacks India. India's response can be to blockade China. Not a close blockade right off the port of Canton with artillery firing into, 1832 or something. No, a distant blockade, which is to say that any bulk carrier, any tanker, which is headed for China, can be stopped. Simply stopped. I mean, you just the airplane flies over and says, return to your departure port. Don't go through. And if they go through, then, you know, one drops a, there are very tiny and harmless little torpedoes that just knock out the propellers. You know, things like that. You don't have to set them on fire and kill the poor sailors and so on. There is, I believe, the India has bought an Israeli missile called Spice, I forget what, but it's so precise that it doesn't really need a warhead. So it doesn't start an explosion or a fire. It just hits and knocks out, you know, the equipment. So whatever it is, blockade is the answer. If the Indian Union, with its billion plus people, is attacked frivolously by the Chinese because Xi Jinping wants to do a Mussolini act. He wants to show that the Chinese are great warriors, which they are not and have never been in their history. If all of this happens, the people of India should not start sacrificing hugely. The answer is blockade. You don't let tankers and bulk carriers reach China. You stop them coming out of the Persian Gulf, Suez Canal, and the ones that are coming from Brazil, for example, they go to the Straits of Malacca. You know, they go around Africa and the Straits of Malacca. And India can do all of that if it stops playing around with aircraft carriers. I mean, you have one. Okay, keep it. But don't spend the money to operate it. You know, use it for show, to show the flag. You know, you don't have to spend all this real money. And instead have land-based aircraft. And, of course, long-range anti-ship missiles, which also are useful. And they can go and use the aircraft carrier called India. Dominate all of this and respond to China in a very unaggressive way. Blockade. You know, just blockade.
But does and, India in its current...
Sorry?
I was going to ask you, does the Indian Navy, as it is today, have the ability or the capability to blockade, let's say, the Malacca Strait?
Well, they have some such ability because they have a number of these P-8s, which are just Boeing 737 with lots of fuel in them and so on. But if they could reallocate the funds from symbolic and demonstrative ceremonial things like aircraft carriers and other surface warships are very dubious these days. You know? As I say, the capital ship of today is the submarine and the aircraft. If they reallocate funds and get just long-range aircraft and put in them the missiles and so on, then they will be able to blockade all these things and so on. And as I say, there's no need to start sinking things and killing people and making a big thing. You just stop them. You just, you know, you see something going and you identify it as headed for China and you say you can't proceed. You can't proceed while your people are killing Indian soldiers in Arunachal. you can't have, you know, your ice cream. No ice cream. Okay. And this is what India can do. And moreover, if the plan, if the Chinese Navy were to try to retaliate against the Indian Navy, first of all, the Indian Navy has considerable capabilities, but that is where the Allies can really come in. Allies can help at sea much more easily than in the air, and far more easily on the ground. If the plan starts going after the Indian Navy, its ships will start blowing up. And who knows whose torpedoes they are? They wouldn't have to be even declared. I mean, the Americans don't like to do this sort of thing, you know, undeclared war and so on. They're very noisy, talkative people. But the Japanese already said that if the Chinese invade Taiwan, they will not be indifferent. And that doesn't mean paratroopers, Japanese paratroopers landing on Beijing, but it does mean that their very good submarines might sort of act. But distant blockade, for example, insofar as the bulk carriers bringing oil and iron ore and so on come from Australia, you wouldn't have to do anything because the Australian government would just stop them in the docks, just like the Americans would not allow any cargoes to be loaded from the West Coast to China. So the Indian Navy doesn't have to start intercepting every damn ship around. No, just a few things that go past, and the others will be stopped at source. By Australia, by the United States, without even needing any particular agreement thereof.
Right. So one thing that perplexes me a lot is, why doesn't India invest more in submarines? We only have about 15 or 16 working submarines, and the Chinese have so many more. I mean, like you said, okay, the submarine is the capital ship. So why is the situation like that?
But don't count them. It's not the number. Not the number. It's the operational level. The level of operation. And the Indian submarines, in some regards, have a good reputation. Because, for example, when the Vietnamese acquired the Russian Kilo submarines, the K, which the Indians also had, the first Vietnamese crews were trained in the Indian facility. On account of the fact that it's very hard to train submariners inside the submarine. You know, it's cramped and difficult. And India has one of those training establishments where they have taken the submarine and took out all the machinery, put it along the walls so that a petty officer can say, look, this is the valve, this is what you do, and you do it, which down inside the submarine is very hard to do. So India has a serious training establishment, which means that they have trained crews. And submarine capabilities start with the ability to operate them. A lot of people who buy submarines and they spend all the time right there, next to the pier, you know, hardly going anywhere, and so on. They're very hard to keep crews warm. India is able to do that. Don't look for numbers, look for quality. Look for quality. And India has had different kinds of submarines. In my view, the best thing they could do would be to buy the Japanese newly, recently retired submarines, because the Japanese pattern is that they produce submarines on a continuing basis. So in order to keep the production plant going, right, what they do is that they replace the submarines when they're still very young. So right now they have a Soryu class, which is very new, and they have a class in reserve, which is also very new, which is not, you know, slightly less new, but it's still a very good submarine, which they're not using. So India could buy those Japanese submarines, which are now in reserve. They're being perfectly maintained. And the Japanese could turn around and buy more of the current submarine for themselves. And India would have a far superior submarine to anything else available around the place. Because things like the nuclear stuff is just too expensive. India has a nuclear submarine and knows how to operate nuclear submarines, but it's just terrifically expensive and they're really not called for. particularly again, this is where friendly powers can really help very readily, you know. And also, there isn't that much need for it, frankly, because the Chinese Navy will have other fish to fry in those situations and other things to do, you know, other missions. But certainly, India's ability must develop a blockade capability. Blockade. A distant and soft blockade augmented by its friends. You know, and the longshoremen in Los Angeles refused to load the container because the Chinese are in the process of attacking India. That happens very easily, you know. And that's a steel blockade. And with the blockade, today's China is very import dependent, as everybody knows. And some of it doesn't count if there's such a conflict. Like, for example, iron ore that the Chinese import to make things they export. Well, they can do with that. But they also depend on things like animal feed. Without animal feed coming in, they will start suffering malnutrition quite soon. It would take maybe 6 months for them to run out of, you know, they will suffer terribly from a blockade. Of course, all the factories will stop. There'll be people milling around asking Xi Jinping, was it really worthwhile to do all this for the Galwan Valley? For us, you know, not to work because there's no raw materials coming in. Now, of course, there is Russia, but there are two railway lines into China. One through Kazakhstan, one through Siberia. There are pipelines and stuff. Now, oil and gas, there will be a lot delivered by pipeline. Not, of course, more than 10% of Chinese needs, so 15 perhaps. But railways, of course, are worthless because one small container ship carries as much as 10 trains. So trying to replace the bulk carriers with the railway things is impossible. So blockade is the thing. India's response is blockade. India itself cannot be blockaded because any attempt to blockade, first of all, India is not dependent on an inflow of bulk carriers the way the Chinese are, much, much less. And secondly, there are all these friendly navies that would prevent the blockade. But it's the Chinese to try and blockade India, that would mean stopping American ships. They're not going to stop Indian ships. They have to stop, you know, foreign ships. And there are foreign navies there. So India cannot be counter-blockaded. That's the big thing.
So does the Indian Navy need more ships to be able to blockade these choke points effectively?
I'm afraid that these days ships are targets. They're only surface ships are targets. They're only submarines and aircraft. Ships are for coast guards, for rescue, for disciplining fishing, and to show the flag. And showing the flag is not a frivolous thing. It has a certain importance. But if you want to fight anything, you want submarines and aircraft. Just visualize the land-based aircraft that takes off, flies for a few hours, drops its ammunition, sinks or whatever it does, sinks ships and so on, drops mines, for example, and then flies back and it reloads and goes again, as opposed to what the ship can deliver. Ships have been poorly treated by technological evolution. You know, large metal objects, impossible to hide, can be attacked by torpedoes. They can be attacked electronically. They can be attacked by aircraft dropping bombs on them, launching missiles. I mean, they are now good for showing the flag. And anybody who then takes it too seriously, and for this flag-showing vessel, they worry a lot about vulnerability and systems and so on, is wasting money.
Why do you think India hasn't adequately militarize the Andaman and Nicobar Islands? It's a great place to have military bases.
Well, you want to start building fortifications. You would, you would just have, there's an airstrip, there's airstrips there. You could have airstrips for and have a bit of fuel there, to be able to operate. You see, the thing about naval aviation, and I don't mean this little airplanes embarked on carriers precariously flying a few sorties and so on. No, which is large airplanes that fly a long distance, is that you would base them there. All you would be refueling. They wouldn't have to sleep there and do heavy maintenance, but you would have refueling bases so that they would, once they fly the big distance from, let's say, the nearest Indian port to the Andaman Nicobar, they can fuel up so they can operate and reach the and operate and have sustainable presence over the Straits of Malacca. And if necessary, the Sunda Straits. If they avoid the Straits of Malacca, they go between Sumatra and Java. That's the Sunda. They can be there too. Now, when I say all this, we have to remember that the Indonesians are no longer neutral as they were, and they're now feeling the pressure of the Chinese. They have sent helicopters with anti-ship missiles to Natuna Island with orders to sink any Chinese ship that tries to enforce their claim over that offshore. So, maybe the Indonesians would take care of the Sunda state anyway. And the Straits of Malacca, there is Malaysia. The Malaysians are the most passive country in the whole world, with the possible exception of San Marino, whose three policemen are not that threatening. The Malaysians are asleep. They sleep. In fact, when the Chinese made the claim against Malaysia, they were forced to send a Chinese ship, and they had a little performance on television of the naval officers solemnly swearing that they're going to defend this piece of China, that being a piece of ocean on the east side of the Malaysian Peninsula, which the Chinese claim. So they had a little ceremony aboard the ship, and when that was broadcast repeatedly on Chinese television, the Malaysians noticed. But they're very lethargic, so you can't rely on them to close the Straits of Malacca. They can't wake out from their sleep. But the Indonesians will stop the Sunda Strait, and the Singaporeans might not be neutral either. Singapore is a very considerable military power. And by the way, a great lesson for the Indian armed forces, because the Singaporeans spend very little money for ceremonial and pretty things. And they don't buy weapons that are not viable. They buy serious stuff. Everything they buy is serious. They're a bit like the Israelis that don't have enough money for dress uniforms. I don't know if you ever seen pictures of Israeli soldiers, but they're always wearing these crumpled battle dress, and officers, don't even have dress uniforms. So the Singaporeans are not quite so extreme as the Israelis, but they also, what they buy is very serious. And they could intervene. They didn't buy all this military equipment for nothing.
So what we are seeing is that an entire quasi-alliance is kind of coming up because of China's actions and belligerence all over.
Well, I said earlier that the Chinese are incompetent at strategy.
Yes.
And my best evidence of that is now that the United States, in its weakness, as the United States is deeply divided, power is mass, multiplied cohesion, multiplied. If you're very disunited, you're very weak. So what do the Americans need? They need allies. And lo and behold, they have allies. The Chinese have kicked India out of its neutrality. They kicked Japan, that was in the neutralist phase, exactly when the Japanese were playing with neutrality. The Chinese went and made the big deal with Senkaku Islands and attacked them. And so they have provide now the United States needs allies. It has allies, not by because of American diplomacy. Usually, weaving alliances and creating alliances requires your whole diplomatic effort. This time, the Americans were distracted. They didn't do anything. It was the Chinese who endowed them with a complete alliance. And nobody would do that unless there were strategic nincompoops, which they have always been. So it's no use. I mean, why else would a great, great nation like China, good at everything except strategy, be repeatedly conquered and then ruled for centuries by small numbers of foreigners? Yeah, you know, literally four guys on horseback. Why? Because they're strategically incompetent. And a lot of, and what's peculiar about this incompetence is that one aspect of the incompetence is that they believe themselves to be great strategists. And it, when you point out to them what's written in Chinese history, they say, oh, but these were Chinese. Oh, the Qing Dynasty? That's a Chinese name. Qing Dynasty? Oh, they were Chinese. You know. Well, they came, but within a week, they became Chinese. Nonsense. Until the last day in Beijing, they were speaking with Yurchen at court, not Mandarin, Yurchen. And they were drinking yogurt and doing other Yurchen things. And it is Chinese nationalist historiography. Chinese historians, deeply ashamed, fabricate the fact that these became Chinese dynasties. The Mongols were definitely Mongols. The Yuan, they call it the Yuan dynasty. They were Mongols. And the Russians to this day call China Kitaiska. Kitaiska, because the Kitai, who are Turkic people, ruled China then. So how come a great nation, good at absolutely everything, keeps being ruled by foreigners? Answer, their strategic nincompoops. And their best evidence is what happened between 2000. I wrote a book called The Rise of China and the Logical Strategy. I wrote that in 2010. It was 2010, 11. It was published 2012. And at that time, Indian government, Mohan Singh, they were not interested in strategy or China or anything else. They were not responding to the border threats of those days. They're just not responding. The Japanese were in the neutralist phase. And in my book, I wrote, I don't care who's the prime minister in Delhi and what he thinks, nor do I care who's the prime minister in Tokyo and what he thinks, because the iron logic of the Chinese threat will force them into opposing and resisting China and force them into becoming allies of the countries behind them, Australia and the United States, that would be supporting them. So I wrote it as a flat prediction. There was no, in my book, there's no on the one hand, the other hand, maybe yes, maybe not. That's what I think, but who knows? Nothing of the kind. It was like the Chinese, and so in fact, the Harvard, it was published by the Harvard University Press. It's a peer-reviewed thing. So the sinologists at Harvard complained that I depicted the Chinese as if they were one of those simple remote control cars, you know, that bump into walls and stuff. I said, no. They're not like that. They're like the very cheap wind-up cars, the ones that wind up that really do bang into walls, and that you can't even avoid the walls. But a sinologist passed the book only because of the fact that every single reference I made to Chinese history was based on the very best sources, and it was, from their perspective, an historiographically correct reference, and it wasn't some simplification and crudity. On that basis, because it's peer-reviewed, you know, the Harvard University Press, they have to be approved there. They approved it for that reason alone, because they couldn't believe that the Chinese would be so stupid as to go around attacking the neighbors and kicking them and threatening them until they formed an anti-China coalition.
Right, so the Chinese have certainly forced everybody to form an anti-China coalition. But what do you think of the Chinese strategy to infiltrate global institutions and create the Belt and Road network and all that?
That they can do, because that doesn't call for strategy, but calls for the art of the bribe, bribing. Now, every Indian knows quite a lot about bribery.
Absolutely.
And the functions of bribery. But in a Chinese case, I would say that they're terrible strategy, but as in bribery, they are all Nobel Prize winners. Because when the Human Rights Commission, the Human Rights Commission or whatever it is of the United Nations meets, after they spend 3 or 4 weeks condemning Israel for everything, then they would turn around and answer about Xinjiang, China's Xinjiang. And 45 countries said that the Chinese are doing wonderfully well in Xinjiang, they're developing Xinjiang, they're raising living standards and so on. 23 of them were Muslim countries who voted for the Chinese. Now, if anybody else destroys a mosque, oh boy, they're all screaming. The Chinese have destroyed hundreds of mosques. But these countries go along. Now, some of them is straight bribery. There are a lot of these, southwestern Africa republics where you just, you write a check and some, and you buy some. Others, like these, a lot of the Muslim countries that voted with China, they voted on the basis of non-interference in domestic affairs. They said the Chinese are sovereign in China. We demand to be sovereign in Bungu Bungu. So therefore, we have the principle. That's how they vote for the Chinese. Be that as it may, the Human Rights Council refuses to condemn China, even though in the case of the Chinese, they've gone a little far because they have forced abortions for Uyghurs. Since Uyghurs, unlike Chinese, actually were allowed to have more than one child because in the original policy, and have a tendency of having children. Modern Chinese, the contemporary Chinese are now told to have three children, each woman is three children, but in fact they're not willing to have even one, most of them. The Uyghurs are different, they like children. So what they do is forced abortions. They do forced abortions, mass detentions, forced abortions, and destruction of Uyghur language education so that these little Uyghurs will grow up speaking Chinese. Because the Chinese government is not racist in the German way. The Germans wanted to wipe out all the Jews and if possible all the Slavs and all that stuff. The Chinese are not racist. They are culture. What they engage in is cultural genocide. They want the Uyghur children to speak Chinese and not to be Uyghur, not to think Uyghur, not to be religious, of course, and to be a little Chinese who looks slightly different. So they're not, they're not physiological racist, they're cultural racist. And of course, they're doing the same in Mongolia. There used to be a Mongolian educational system. Now they stop teaching in Mongolian, except the Mongolian language, and they want to annihilate Tibet's national character. They want the herdsmen, they want to lift the herdsmen, prevent them from being herdsmen, make them industrial workers so they can move around China. So they're engaging in cultural genocide. But nobody condemns them at the UN because at the UN, it's a bankrupt entity, doesn't serve any purpose other than people to, sit around in useless conferences where they say things that are not true. But in that, it shows how good they are at bribery. They're really good. A lot of Indians think they're good at bribery, but nothing like the Chinese.
The Chinese have a long-term vision and they use that to strategically bribe, I suppose.
They don't have a long-term vision in regard to their best strategic interest because there was no long-term reason to quarrel with the Japanese just when the Japanese were beginning to prefer neutralism. It was absolutely no long-term vision about picking a quarrel with India, which has lots of weaknesses, but which, after all, is a country that has a few inhabitants, it has some magnitude, has a few people living in it, and quarrel with them over gaining 170 square meters of tundra in Ladakh, fighting a fight over them, prolonging the quarrel by, putting out all this propaganda stuff and having the Olympic torchbearer and stuff. That is not anything. That is only the behavior of autistic people. They're like an autistic child. And they've always been like. Whenever they dealt with foreigners, they don't know how to deal with them. That's why they were defeated by foreigners and ruled and invaded themselves. But they always think there's some clever thing. So when the Japanese arrived, the Chinese tried clever things. You know, the communists were very clever. They let the nationalists fight. The nationalists were very clever. Everybody's very, very clever. In the meantime, they couldn't budge. The Japanese took whatever they wanted. And as I say, if the Americans had not defeated Japan, the Japanese would still be occupying China. I would have to add, if Stalin wasn't willing to help the Chinese, which he might not have because he didn't particularly like them, if it was up to the Chinese, they would still be occupied by Japan today. Right? So, you know, but they can bribe worthless institutions like the UN. You can be bribed, you know, can bribe your way into it. Can bribe support, you know, that kind of stuff. And they're doing that. And of course, they're extremely good at economic stuff, at working, business, everything. They're great at absolutely everything. I also, by the way, like Chinese poetry a lot. I like Beijing opera. That's a bit of an acquired taste, but I love Beijing opera. I love these singing they have, you know, and that kind of stuff. They're great at everything. Just dealing with foreigners, they're total nincompoops.
Do you see China being able to invade and conquer Tibet sometime in the next 10 years? Do you think it's possible?
Invade and conquer? And
Tibet? I'm sorry, Taiwan? Taiwan?
Taiwan? No. I think that this is not the year to invade and conquer Taiwan because President Biden suffered the debacle of Kabul. And he cannot afford the second debacle. Don't knock people when they've just suffered a humiliation because they're going to respond. Chinese know that. That's why, indeed, Xi Jinping's bellicosity is expressed against India. Because of that reason, against India. But no, I don't think they can grab Taiwan. American admirals solemnly meet and do war games, and the answer is always that they can. And that the U.S. Navy loses an aircraft carrier and whatever happens. And so on. And because when American admirals talk about the war game is always one where the U.S. Navy loses. Then they show up in front of Capitol Hill with their begging bowls to get some more money, okay? The Air Force, strange enough, doesn't, with their war games, they don't lose. And the Army, to be on the safe side, doesn't do war games. But the Navy always loses and therefore needs more money so they can build their ships in their way. $100 million for a small landing craft. When you see the landing craft, you think it's $3 million. No, it's not.
Right. So in case, just hypothetically, if China were to conquer Taiwan sometime in the next 10 years, what would then be the threat for India? Would the threat change? Chinese Navy the
Taiwan, be allowed to conquer Taiwan, then the least you would expect would be that the countries around China would be on a warpath. They would mobilize. Everybody would be on their toe. Everybody would get mobilized. You know, the Japanese, as you know, spend 1% of their GDP on defense. When you spend 1% on anything, you can afford to spend 3%. Now, the Japanese forces are considerable. Their navy is a very powerful navy. The Air Force is powerful as well. They have these old F-15s, but they have 200 plus of them. It's the most formidable tactical air power in the whole of Asia by far, right? So if Taiwan falls, the Japanese defense budget doubles. There are very few countries that can double the defense budget and not notice it. To go from 1% to 2%. They might go to 3%. Whereupon it will be, you know, very scary for anybody else because they're serious people. when other people's officers visit Japanese ships and they see that every damn, you know, ships are full of machines, and half the time, you know, half the time, half of them don't really work. Japanese ships, they all work, always, you know. Well, as you would expect, you know, national character. So follow Taiwan means Japan doubles its defense spending, maybe triples it. That would be a considerable force. I believe that countries like, you know, even the Philippines might do something, the Indonesians certainly, and all the countries around. The Vietnamese are already on the war path. There'll be even more, and they would cooperate more with other countries like Japan, the United States, India, and so on. Yeah, there will be a militarization triggered by such an event.
How do you see the threat of Pakistan to India? Is Pakistan genuinely a threat, or is it just an appendage of the Chinese?
First of all, Krishna Swami Subramanian's brilliant logic applies. The Pakistani threat has to be below the nuclear threshold. They might do some sort of brigade engagement. If their Chinese friends are in bad trouble, they might relieve the pressure by doing a brigade operation in Rajasthan. So there'll be some, armored combat. The two sides are more or less kind of agreed how to play that, you know, Indian armor, Pakistani armor, you know, maneuvers and so on. That's the limit of it, because, you know, there is a nuclear threshold, as there is between China and India, there is between India and Pakistan, and that confines activities. But they can make trouble, they can do a few things, but if there's no configuration where, unless somebody goes mad in Delhi and starts sending the Indian army to freeze to death up there in those mountains, and then whatever is sent is always a fraction of the total force. So the Pakistani capability is limited. And their, you know, their total force is very little. They used to have the American alliance that provided them with high quality aircraft and so on. That's all over. That's all finished. They still have some, you know, leftover U.S. equipment. They have other equipment, but, you know, it's all very limited. India has grown, relative to Pakistan, India has grown much more, as you know. Look at the GDPs and so on.
How do you view the strategic cooperation between Pakistan, between China and Russia? Is that an alliance or is it something else?
Oh, yeah. Well, you've seen the pictures, I hope. Xi Jinping practically kissing Putin. You know, it looks like they might get married. So that must be a very, very close alliance. Except that it so happens that the only country that fights China every day, Vietnam, is supplied by Russia. And another country that we're talking about that interests you, India, is supplied by Russia. I was actually in Delhi in September. I violated the rules because foreigners were not supposed to be in Delhi. But, you know, I'm a bit of an undisciplined character. So I was in Delhi and I run in my hotel. There are all these Russians. So I asked them, I said, I speak Russian. I said, what are you here for? Are you selling ice cream or something? You know, they had this salesman look. And he said, no, we're selling. One was selling aircraft, the other was selling. There was a huge Russian delegation to India to offer more Russian weapons and upgraded weapons. And I believe the Russians supply India with the highest quality aviation equipment. China and Russia, Xi Jinping and Putin love each other. However, it must be a coincidence. It's just a coincidence that Russia is the only principal supplier of Vietnam and an important supplier of India who are fighting the Chinese. It must be a coincidence. But I think not. I think the Russians understand that they can live 1,000 years in an American-dominated world, and they can't live a week in a Chinese-dominated world. Because if you think that China has claims against India, you should see their claims against Russia. The whole of the maritime provinces is their claim. They claim it all there. Now, they don't claim it at all, but as the researcher, the famous researcher at the Vladivostok Navy University writes, every Chinese claim not actively advanced is dormant. Dormant, right. That being a sophisticated world to mean that it's asleep, waiting for the right moment to wake up. So the Russians know all this. So any accommodation between Putin and Xi Jinping is strictly tactical. And as they stand side by side, beaming like two good friends, each has a dagger in his hand. Or at least it has weapon supplies in his hand.
So, Dr. Lutwak, you wrote China, this very famous book.
Sorry, pardon me?
Please continue, sir.
Have we finished?
Just one more question.
Yes.
Just one more question. So you wrote this very famous book, Coup d'Etat, which is essentially a manual of how to conduct that. Do you see a coup happening in China sometime in the future? Because China is a country that's prone to that.
A Chinese coups would have to be within the Communist Party.
Yes.
And the way they happen is that the machinery of a coup in the Chinese Communist Party would have to be something like there is a meeting of the Politburo Standing Committee, but they forget to invite Xi Jinping. Whereupon the Standing Committee members vote him out. Or Xi Jinping comes to a Standing Committee meeting as scheduled, and instead of everybody bowing down and being silent and so on, as soon as he sits down and he wants to speak, somebody says, I need to make a statement first. You have made enemies out of all our neighbors, Xi Jinping. You have humiliated and abused Indians. You have threatened Japanese. You have threatened Indonesians. You set Filipinos. You made enemies of all our neighbors. All of them invite the Americans and cooperate with the Americans, and you're bloody incompetent, and get out. That's one possibility. The least likely one, because the Chinese nationalist mind is able to, transmute everything into the opposite. The Japanese were plotting. When they were pretending to be going neutral, the American embassy was in a panic because they were going so neutral. No, it was all a pretense. Japanese are very deceptive. They really weren't going neutral when we started kicking them over the Senkaku, things like that. However, it could be something else. It could be, for example, the fact that he's had this anti-corruption campaign. People have been executed by firing squad, or sent to life in prison. Their families were kicked out of the party residence they had and became, lived miserably. All of these things, but his sister, the billionaire sister of Xi Jinping, continues to be a billionaire sister of Xi Jinping. And it's not like she ever worked a day in her life. She didn't. And what happened is that a huge insurance company licensed by the state, a licensed state light called Ping An, decided to offer her some shares. Billionaire. She and her husband are billionaire. So it's in the political standing committee meeting that say, you sent my third cousin. My third cousin was executed for corruption. But what about your sister? What about your sister's children? Etc. So that could be it. But anyway, the thing is this, they hold the meeting and forget to invite him. When he shows up, they arrest him. That's how it's done, the coup in the Communist Party.
Do you think it's likely anytime in the next few years?
Well, I think he's done horrible harm to China. He in the good old days of Hu Jintao was the primus inter pares, the first among equal. He ran the Politburo. It wasn't like Mussolini or something. He was one of the guys, and he was a little more prominent than the others. There was a small gap between Hu Jintao and other people, very small. And his prime minister, Wen Jiabao, was like his friend. They were together side by side. Whereas Xi Jinping has made himself into a colossal entity. When they meet together now, as I think I told you, everybody dutifully looks down, reading some text to Xi Jinping while he talks over their heads, and they say nothing. You watch it on CCTV, and they don't say a word. So he's done fairly extraordinary. He has changed things in such a way that his removal becomes very attractive.
Right. Dr. Luthwaak, thank you so much for a very, very interesting conversation. Thank you so much.
You ask clever questions. Good.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.